from WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The universe, to the best of our knowledge, is inconsistent. There's still a lot we don't fully understand, like gravity or what happens at extreme energies. My guest today, top flight physicist Lisa Randall, says we're finally making headway on some of these big questions about the universe and its origins that have stumped scientists for centuries. She's also a passionate advocate for the value of scientific thinking and why logic, reason, and evidence trump faith. This hour on Point, the universe, from subatomic quarks to the cosmos, and the importance of scientific thinking with Lisa Randall. You can join the conversation. How would a major discovery about the origin of the universe change the world we live in? What's your question on the cosmos? And joining me now from New York is Lisa Randall. She's professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University, where she studies particle physics and cosmology. Renowned for her work on extra dimensions of space, she's also a science popularizer, author of Warped Passages, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Universe's Hidden Dimension. Her latest book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. And Lisa Randall, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's start, if we could, with the title. I know you get asked this every time, but it's so intriguing. I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, by the way, and that song is a beautiful one about a man who is mortally wounded at the end of his life knocking on heaven's door. You have a different sort of take on what that means.
Yeah, I think anyone who read my first book, War Passages, knows that I tend to misappropriate song lyrics when the words somehow seem appropriate and it interpreted a different way. In this case, I actually thought the words also, in a completely different context, very beautifully expressed the how science really works, in the sense that we have a core body of knowledge. We have a completely consistent theory. It does all work. But of course, research involves trying to go beyond that, trying to go to those places where the inconsistencies arise, where new ideas arise. That is to say, what we have is works. It's successful. It's been tested. But we're trying to see what underlies it. What are the rules that go beyond that? What are the things that we're missing at this point? And so I thought it was a nice way of expressing this idea of looking at the edges.
Looking at the edges, right at the edge there of heaven's door. Is this why? Well, let me just put it this way. What appealed to you from an early age about physics? Why were you drawn to it as a field of study?
Well, it depends how early we're talking about. I think at an early age, I liked doing math. I didn't study physics until high school. And in math, I think I liked the fact that you had answers, that there were rules and answers. Of course, what is appealing about science, you eventually learn, is all the stuff you don't know. If you're just going over things that people have already done, that's, of course, nice and satisfying, but it's not the same satisfaction as when you really discover something new about the universe. It's funny, because I think when I first started, I really was more interested in just sort of what we're doing, the sort of, in a sense, game playing, trying to put together these puzzle pieces. And it was over time that I began to really appreciate how it really does connect with what we're saying about the universe, what we are saying about experiments, that these ideas really could represent reality that's out there.
There's so much in this book that I want to get into. There's a lot about how scientists work and do their experiments, about the latest research at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, which I want to ask you about. You also make an argument in favor of scientific thinking, and I want to get to all of that. But let me ask you, what's the most important point that you want readers to take away from this book?
I'm always bad with those ist questions. There really are two different parts of the book, and I think different readers will want to see different things. But one is about what's going on today in the world of physics, what's going on at the Large Hadron Collider in cosmology. But the other part is about the nature of science, what it really is. We're often presented with a very clean, pristine picture of sort of a set of rules and that we derive things, and that's how it works. And of course, once we've figured something out and have ideas that have been well tested, that is how it works. But before that point, when you're actually doing research, it's somewhat messier, and we're trying to piece together ideas. I do theoretical physics. I describe the experiments, and I care about what they do. I'll predict what they should find, and experiments will tell me what they're finding. But ultimately, we're all trying to get at answers, but that doesn't mean we know the answer right away. We're trying to put together the clues. And just the kind of
ways of thinking that go into it, the role of uncertainty, for example, what it means to be right and wrong, how science really advances. So these are, in some sense, they seem like obvious points, but they're also subtle points. And I think they're often missed in our description of what science is. And I think sometimes that leads to sort of false debates about scientific issues.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that, about how scientific laws are established and how they prevail. I mean, you know, we think of people like Einstein who just got up one day and said, well, E equals MC squared, and that became one of the biggest principles upon which physics is based. But of course, it didn't happen like that, right? I mean, so how do correct scientific ideas prevail, I guess, is the question.
There's not one single answer. It's a number of elements that go into it. In the case of Einstein, there were things that didn't make sense to him in terms of thought experiments, in terms of theories about actually electromagnetism that had been found at the time, and he saw some structure in that. So one of the things that was going into was looking for structure, looking for understanding and making more consistent theories. So, but of course, you also want economical theories in the sense that they can describe as many phenomena as possible. And, of course, you also want these ideas to be testable. There have to be experiments, ultimately, that verify whether these ideas are true or false before we know them to be correct. In the case of Einstein, there were really critical experiments, such as the bending of light, that established one of his theories. So it's this combination of ideas that are being thought about, putting them together, trying to make ideas consistent, trying to predict phenomena and seeing whether they hold up to test.
And tell us, Lisa Randall, why this kind of primary as opposed to applied research is worth doing, particularly in such tough times.
Well, you have to think about different timescales. There's the short term and there's the long term. Ultimately, if we don't expand our knowledge, there aren't big ideas. And if you look back in the past, it is a tough argument to make, and I'm not trying to minimize it. It's not obvious what the results of basic scientific research will be. But if you look in the past, if you just look at the data, when there have been big scientific breakthroughs, there have been amazing changes that have had repercussions throughout our society and economy. I mean, no one knew when they discovered electricity that it would change the face of the planet. Mm. Quantum mechanics led to semiconductors in the electronics industry. Even CERN, not the physics itself, but trying to get all these physicists from different nations working together.
You're talking about the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, right? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. CERN is where the Large Hadron Collider is based, and this organization is in Europe and has many European nations participating. And in the process of trying to get them to work together efficiently, Tim Berners-Lee developed the World Wide Web. So it's not a simple argument to make because we can't predict. We're not looking for those applications at the time we're thinking about basic science. Yet, when we find big results, they often do have implications. On top of that, of course, when you have good science, you have an educated populace, you have advances, you have people who are asking interesting questions and thinking about big questions. So it seems to all be a big package. It's not easy to make a one-to-one correspondence, but overall it's clear that things advance when science advances.
I got a great email from a friend today when I told him that I was talking to you. He's a big fan of yours, and he wrote this. He said, the most famous equation in the history of science is Einstein's E equals MC squared, which we were just mentioning. I've read that it gave us the GPS system and nuclear power. Is that true? Are those the kinds of applications and the real value of primary research that we're talking about?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what real value means. I'm pretty happy for the ideas to be present in and of themselves. But it is true that general relativity is used in GPS systems. Without it, people would predict the wrong answers if they just did it by purely theoretical calculations. In terms of nuclear power, of course, nuclear power is directly a result of masses being converted into energy. So yes, those are true statements.
Mm. The importance of scientific thinking. What can scientific thinking do for us beyond just making amazing discovery on the part of, very smart people like you?
I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from scientific thinking. And there are lessons that, we do sometimes incorporate and we sometimes forget. We have ways of first of all, asking, I think, again, people tend to have a very narrow view of what science is. Instead of equations, you predict things. But science teaches us other things, how to ask the right questions, how to understand the questions we're asking, how to understand what our assumptions are, what are the uncertainties that go into those assumptions, what are the uncertainties in the predictions that we have. It's a way of tackling big questions by looking at little questions and making progress by trying to answer the smaller questions and finding tractable questions and being able to put it all together. So I think it's scientific thinking, but it's also rational thinking. It's trying to learn from what we can see around us, what policies have been implemented before, what do they teach us, how to make predictions, and where we should be asking questions.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're exploring space, time, and the shape of the universe with physicist Lisa Randall. She's professor of theoretical physics at Harvard and author of the new book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. And Lisa Randall, I do want to ask you about the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. But just before the break, we were talking about sort of the value of scientific thinking. And you make a case that scientific thinking, for example, could help us evaluate risk in fields outside of science. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, of course, there are many levels at which we can think about risk. And one is, of course, the very technical scientific way. But again, I think what scientific thinking teaches us is to look at scales. So when we ask about risk, who are we asking about the risk for? Is it an individual, a company, a nation, the economy? When we talk about risk, what kind of time scales are we talking about? And again, scientists know that you would make different predictions, possibly over different time scales, depending on what kind of question you're asking. It also teaches us to understand and appreciate uncertainties. When we make a prediction, we say, what are the assumptions that go into that? And if we make too narrow a set of assumptions, then the predictions are untrustworthy. So it's important to look at the full range of possible assumptions when we want to make a prediction that matters quite a lot.
So just to draw on sort of a recent calamity in the not-too-distant past, is there an argument to be made that if the folks at Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns were thinking more like scientists, they might have thought twice about securitizing all those toxic mortgage assets and pushing us to the edge of financial ruin?
Again, I think it does depend on which question they were asking. If they were asking a question of, can we make money tomorrow? Maybe not. But if they were asking, is this a stable policy to follow in the long term? Obviously no. Another really important aspect of science is that the answers trump opinions, that there's no single expert that just carries the weight of everyone's opinion, that we really do listen widely. So if there was someone who said, you know, that result looks nice, but you left this out. I mean, when I was a beginning postdoctoral fellow, there was a big result that was considered a great confirmation of what's called the standard model of particle physics. And I realized they actually hadn't taken something into account. I said, actually, if you take this into account, there's a much broader range of possibilities. And because I was a smaller person, it took a little bit longer to listen, but people did listen, and it changed the way people were presenting the results. So I think it's very important when you have big questions to be able to appreciate and understand possible objections. It doesn't mean that everyone has something to say that's worth paying attention to over a long time, but if there are possible objections, you want to hear them.
We're talking to Lisa Randall. She's a professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University. She's also author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. Lisa Randall, we have a lot of listeners who want to get in on this conversation, so let's go to some of them right now. Ron is calling from Pittsburgh. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Anthony.
Good to have you. What's on your mind?
I have a question for Lisa. Lisa, aside from the study of the technicalities of the universe, my question would be this. Your personal feelings, when you step back and look at all this, what are your personal feelings? Do you say to yourself, what kind of creature or creatures created this? Now, I don't mean in a religious sense. I mean in a cold, hard scientific view that you would have, do you say to yourself, my goodness, who are these creatures that created this universe and this scientific realm, and where did they come from? What does this tell you about, or does not tell you about, the, I don't know if I even word it right, what kind of a mind or a creature created this universe?
All right, Ron.
There are two things that I'll say to this. One is that there's sort of a dirty secret in science that actually the origins are really hard questions about anything, because we can study what we have today. We can go back in time. But in the case of physics, going back to what we might consider the beginning, say the Big Bang, is really tough, both experimentally but also theoretically. We're in a realm where we don't know how to approach it. How life started is also a really big question. We know evolution, but how it started is tough. But that's one thing. But in terms of taking a step back and looking, I think I would almost take the opposite point of view, that it's just, in some sense, it's humbling but also inspiring what we can learn about the universe. The fact is the universe is much bigger than we are. One of the important themes in my book is scale, just where we are and what makes the science so difficult to have intuition for, but also the fact is that we can use technology to get to scales well beyond the human scale. We can get to very tiny scales. We can get to very large scales. And by get to them, I mean really understand what are the basic rules there, what are the basic ingredients, what's going on at these scales, so removed from the ones that we encounter in our daily lives, and where the laws of physics even might appear to be so different from what we're familiar with. And one of the important ideas is how this can build on itself into a consistent picture. But I think it also makes us appreciate just what a small part of this we are. And often when we're trying to understand the universe, it gets confused because there's a universe that's out there. It's very nice we're there to be able to understand it and that we can understand it. But we sometimes get overly caught up with how we're viewing it. That's not the question. The question is, what is there?
Hmm. Speaking of very tiny scales, I want to ask you about the Large Hadron Collider, which you write about in this book. Tell us first, and I'm going to just ask the most basic question. What does this huge machine do, and what do we hope to learn from it?
Well, some of it is in the name. It's called the Large Hadron Collider. So it's large. It's a 27-kilometer ring where protons, which are a form of particle they could have called it the Large Proton Collider, but they called it the Large Hadron Collider, and they collide those protons together. So what happens is protons are collided together at enormously high energy. The advantage of having high energy is that E equals MC squared, as we said, tells us that with more energy, we can create particles with bigger mass, M, which means we can learn about particles we've never been able to see before and study in detail. The other advantage is that by going to large energies, we're studying small distances. So we're seeing structure at distances beyond what we've ever been able to explore before. So there are some big questions that we think this is the right energy to answer. So by having these proton collisions and looking what comes out of those collisions, that they collide, they turn into energy, and that energy turns into other particles. Most of the time, it turns into standard model particles that we already know about. But a rare fraction of the time, the hope is that it will turn into the new stuff we haven't seen before that will give us not just insights into what's there in terms of what the ingredients are, but also what are the rules that apply at those scales? What are the laws of nature? What are the forces?
Mm. And one of the things that we're searching for is this thing called the Higgs boson particle. Tell us what that is.
So to understand what the Higgs boson particle, you have to understand that there's something called the Higgs mechanism.
Mm.
These are both named after the physicist Peter Higgs. And the idea is that elementary particles, it seems almost inconsistent for elementary particles to have mass. If they just had masses from the get-go, you would make inconsistent predictions, things like probabilities of interacting scattering greater than one, which don't make sense. So you need a mechanism that explains how elementary particles get their mass. And it seems that a perfectly consistent mechanism is this Higgs mechanism, which in some sense says something like a charge is spread throughout space.
And when I say space, I mean empty space, no actual particles. So the vacuum, the state with no particles in it, still has this sort of charge off which particles can scatter. Heavier particles would interact more, lighter particles would interact less, and that would explain why the heavier particles have bigger masses, and the lighter particles have less. But this is an idea. It seems to be consistent theoretically, but the question is, first of all, is it right? Is this really what's going on? And second, what was around that distributed this charge throughout the vacuum? How did it get there? So to do that, we need to know what the particles that are involved are. And in the simplest, most straightforward implementation of the Higgs mechanism, the experimental consequence would be a particle that we call the Higgs boson. It's a particle whose interactions we know a lot about because it interacts the most with the heaviest particles and the least with the lightest particles. And that makes it a really nice search target because we can predict its properties. And so experimenters are right now looking for the Higgs boson. And the hope is before the machine turns off for an upgrade, we should remember that the Large Hadron Collider is now running at only half its target energy. But so it's going to turn off and then turn back on at that target energy. But even right now, with half the energy, it has a real chance of shedding light on this question of the Higgs boson particle.
I've heard you talk about this this Large Hadron Collider and some of the sort of great theories that might come out of it, or the great discoveries. And one of the things I've heard you talk about, it's where I stop comprehending, and I just can't get my mind around it. You talk about the possibility of an extra dimension of space. I need you to explain that. I don't think I understand that.
Well, it depends what we mean by understand. I think a lot of people think of understand as picturing it and being able to appreciate it with their senses. It's a dimension beyond what we can see. It's a dimension beyond which we can picture it.
So it doesn't exist in space. It doesn't exist in time. It doesn't exist.
No,
in...
it is a form of space if it exists. It's a space beyond the three dimensions we see: left, right, up, down, forward, backward.
Yeah.
It would be another coordinate, if you like, another direction that we haven't experienced ourselves. Mm. You might say, why should we even imagine something we haven't experienced ourselves? But if you think about it, we haven't experienced atoms, most of us, directly. We experience something that is a summary of what atoms are, such as the tabletop you might be leaning on. But that's not the same as seeing these ingredients themselves. So there might well be dimensions of space, or at least a single dimension beyond what we directly see or experience. And what's so interesting about that is if it's true, it could possibly have implications for our world. It could explain properties of our universe. In particular, one of the big questions the Large Hadron Collider is trying to answer is a question about why gravity is so weak compared to other fundamental forces.
And explain so that. Gravity is weak because, again, I'm laughing because I watched a clip of Stephen Colbert say to you, gravity's not weak. Have you ever jumped off a 15-story building? But I know you don't mean that. But explain what you mean by gravity is weak.
Well, as a fundamental force, gravity is weak. Remember, when you jump off that building, you have the entire Earth acting on you. Mm. You can actually, the fact that you can jump up and down, or that you can pick up a paperclip with a tiny magnet, is some indication that it's fundamentally a pretty weak force. And if you had elementary particles, the force of gravity is completely negligible compared to other forces. Another way of saying that is that, in some sense, stuff is much lighter than we might expect it to be. If particles were really heavy, they would have a very strong gravitational force, but they're not. And the question is, why is everything as light as it is, in light of the fact that our theories would have predicted that it should be heavier? It's a really big mystery for particle physics. It sounds like, well, you just put in the number, but it turns out it's almost inconsistent because of quantum mechanical effects. That tells us there really is something going on. There really is something more fundamental underlying the well-tested standard model of particle physics that describes matter's most basic elements and their interactions. And the question we have is, what is that? And what's so amazing is it really does, it's a difficult question, and it does seem that whatever is the answer, well, it could be something big, something like an extra dimension of space, or an extension of space-time symmetries into the quantum regime and something known as supersymmetry. It doesn't seem like simple theories answer that question. So we do think that there could be something very interesting waiting to be discovered.
Lisa Randall is author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. We're taking your calls at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to John, who's calling from New York City. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Hi, Anthony. I recently stumbled on the debate about the expanding Earth. And I'm not entirely convinced of it yet, but I'm fascinated by about how compelling the physical evidence is that the Earth has been expanding over the last hundreds of millions of years. There's no mechanism yet to describe this, but there, the physical evidence, there's a whole laundry list of striking.
This isn't my field of expertise. I don't really know about this at all.
Well, it's fascinating. For example, the age of the seafloor, they've taken measurements of the age of the seafloor over all over the world, and the patterns of the ages of the seafloor are, describe the.
John, I think I'm going to thank you for your call and probably move on to a couple of others, only because Lisa Randall just said this probably isn't her area of expertise, but it's certainly an intriguing idea, and I'm very, very grateful that you called in. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Waitsfield, Vermont. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks. I think the conversations are fascinating. I can't wait to check out this book. And I'm calling as a science fiction
writer. We like this caller.
Pardon me?
You made a good start, Paul.
All right, great. I don't want to be hokey with this question at all, but I am interested in this field in a more creative way. So I guess it's twofold. One is, how much is creative thought and just kind of that inspirational spark influencing your work and perhaps the field itself? And then the second question, potentially the more hokey one, is, with this work, and maybe, I don't know if can voice your opinion on this matter, but do you think the potentiality of ancient astronauts visiting Earth and all that kind of craziness, and or even the fact that there may be extraterrestrial beings out in the cosmos somewhere?
I think that's a great question, even if you want to call it hokey. Lisa, we have about 15 seconds or so before the break, so take a stab at it, and then we'll come back and pick it up.
Are there creatures? We probably won't see them. And in terms of the other question, yes, the creativity is really important. I have a whole chapter about that, but it's complicated to define what creativity is. It has to do with inspiration, but it also has to do with having sharp technical skills that you can call in to evaluate your ideas.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. Our guest today is Lisa Randall, professor at Harvard University, where she studies particle physics and the cosmos. Her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door. And Lisa Randall, I gave you about 7.5 seconds to to answer
a very complicated
question before the break. So why don't you expand on that caller question?
So it's funny because actually the first chapter of my book is it is about the kind of things that are possible in light of what we know, how ideas build on themselves, so that it's not that what we know is wrong, but we can have other things that we find out are true in domains we haven't yet studied. So a lot of the confusions that arise about what science allows are because we fail to make this distinction about looking at length scales and figuring out what's going on. So sometimes people have bizarre possibilities that they say, can't this happen? And it might happen, but it's not going to happen in a human domain that we can access. But that doesn't mean there aren't amazing possibilities that are allowed, and one of them certainly is the idea that there is life beyond our experience and directly experience, but that doesn't mean that we're ever going to know about it, which is a different question entirely. But I really like the question about creativity, too, because I think a lot of the time people have a very limited view of what science is and what scientists do. They think that creativity is the domain of the arts and literature. But, of course, science involves a lot of creativity, too. It's interesting creativity because it's creativity in a constrained setting. We know things about the universe, and ultimately our ideas are interesting insofar as they describe what's actually out there. But that doesn't mean there's not a lot of creative thinking that goes into it. And that you can't pinpoint one ingredient. There are many different ways that people can be creative. They can be creative technically. They can be creative by just understanding things really well and putting together information in interesting ways, applying information to a different domain by asking the right questions, by having a large – one of the I think, very important aspects of creativity in both the arts and the sciences, is having big questions in mind, but finding the little questions that you can actually attack and make progress on. And all of this generally relies on having a firm skill set that allows you to work through these ideas in a reliable fashion. So the question of creativity, I think, is a very important one.
Let's go to Lisa, who's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Anthony. Hello, Dr. Randall. I want to thank you for taking my call, and also thrilled to be able to talk to you. My 15-year-old son has been reading your book, and that's how I had first heard about it. And he's very interested in theoretical physics, and he and I have been having a lot of conversations. He's been watching the recent PBS series Brian Greene on the Fabric of the Cosmos. We were having a dinner time conversation the other day, and I was telling him because we had the program had discussed the fact that you know, why is time going in one direction, and relating it to the fact that the entropy of the universe is increasing. And I mentioned to him, because my son and I often have debates on, you know, God and religion and other things as well. I said, when I was taking quantum physics in the spring of 1975, and Professor Francis Lowell of the MIT Theoretical Physics Center was the lecturer, and he gave a lecture which ended, it says, yes, you know, the entropy of the universe has been increasing since the Big Bang, and what had to have happened in order for this to be the case is that something had to have pushed everything back into its ordered state. And when he said that, and this is what 35 years ago, the entire classroom on 26100 broke into applause. And my takeaway message, I'm not sure I have a question here, but the fact is that what I have come to understand over all this time is that, if anything, the study of theoretical physics has increased my sense of spirituality and belief in something else, just because the universe is too weird for us to really fathom.
Lisa, you get to a great point, which is our time is running short, so I want to make sure that I give Lisa Randall plenty of time to talk about this. But pick up Lisa's point there about the connection with science and spirituality.
Well, I think that science is a different, very different way of approaching the world, in the sense that spirituality, it depends how you define it. Spirituality can be a way that we as human beings experience the world. It could be psychological or social phenomena. But when we actually think that there are external elements that come in and play a role in how the universe functions, that is very different than science. That's not what science says. Science doesn't claim to have all the answers at any given point. It says what we know and what we don't know yet. But there is a belief, and it is a belief, that what we do see is based on fundamental material elements that interact through material forces. If you want to believe that spirituality has something to do with it, you then have to believe that spirituality affects those elementary ingredients. So if I think spirituality affects my moral choices, then I have to believe that it's working at some deep level inside my brain. I find that hard to fathom. If we talk about the very beginning, as I said, we don't yet understand what happened at the very beginning as scientists, and I don't want to claim that we do. As scientists, though, we do think there probably is a scientific answer. That doesn't mean we have yet found it.
Does that mean you Lisa, go ahead.
I mean, there are these big questions, and they are questions that are difficult to believe that we will answer sometimes, but it's also difficult to believe that we've made as much progress as we have. We can look back at the cosmic microwave background and see detailed structure that we can predict from very early in the universe. So I think that looking at science also gives me faith that human beings can figure out some amazing things.
Sorry that I stepped on you there. I was just intrigued by what you said. Does this mean that you can't both be a scientist and a believer in an all-powerful God that created all of this,
for example? First of all, as any human being knows, we all hold a lot of contradictory beliefs in our heads at a given time. So technically the answer is, of course you can be. The question is, when you have those beliefs, is that assisting you in your science? Is it something you're doing when you're doing your science? And there are ways in which that we are asking questions. And, of course, a lot of human qualities come into it. And before we've rigorously shown what is right, we are thinking about things in a different way, and you can get your inspiration wherever you want. But the fact is that that's not the scientific part of it. That's part that's entering into your going about what you do. But then when you have science, ultimately, it's describing what's there. It's in a testable way that other people can also test and also verify. So I would say that the difference, you know, and I did think about it. I think the difference really has to do with where you believe that whatever it is playing a role. Do you really think it's affecting the material elements of the universe, or is it just something that you find comfort in if it helps you think about the world? It doesn't mean that I do, but if other people want to, they're free to do so. But that's not science.
But do you believe, could you imagine, for example, that science could one day answer all the basic questions that religion seeks to grapple with?
I really doubt it. I think it's a kind of amazing thought that anything can answer all the questions. I don't think religion answers all those questions, too, but people might find comfort in what religion is telling them. I think that it would be remarkable for anyone to live at a given time where we've answered all the questions. I mean, one of the important points that's often confused is even if we had the most fundamental ingredients, even if we knew all those ingredients, you still have to understand how those ingredients fit together to create all the many phenomena that we see in our world. There's a lot of questions out there. It would be remarkable if science or any way of thinking would answer all those questions. But that doesn't mean that we don't make progress. It doesn't mean that science isn't a very good way to go about trying to get at some of these questions. It doesn't mean that people don't have the freedom to put in human qualities when they're thinking about things. But I think we have to remember those are human qualities. That's the way humans are interacting and trying to understand things. But it doesn't tell us that there's a limitation to science, but we don't yet know what those limitations are until we really try.
Let's take a few more calls. Sid is calling from Prospect, Connecticut. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Anthony. My question is about dark matter. Why is it such a mystery? And are we making any progress toward determining what exactly it is? And is the Hadron Collider going to be explaining how that all works?
Sid, so great question.
Thank you for asking that.
And Lisa, tell us, first of all, what dark matter is, first of all.
Yeah, so I actually have, I actually do talk in detail about dark matter. And it's really, those are really good questions. So first of all, dark matter is a misnomer. It's transparent matter. It's matter that doesn't interact with light. So out there in the universe, the stuff that we know about, the stuff we're made of, is only about 4% of the energy of the universe. Dark matter has about 6 times the amount of energy as the matter we're made of. There's also something called dark energy, which I'm not going to address now, which is energy not carried by matter. So let's focus on dark matter. Why is it so mysterious? Well, one of the reasons is that it is transparent, that it is, doesn't interact with light. It's hard to find. We know about its existence because of its gravitational effects, but we don't yet know what it is as a fundamental object. Is it a fundamental particle? If so, what is its mass? What are its properties? Does it have any interactions? Does it have interactions we don't yet know about? What's really interesting is, in addition to the Large Hadron Collider, today is a very good era in experiments for dark matter. There are experiments that look for dark matter in 3 different ways. One has to do with direct detection, which is to say, on Earth, there are huge vats. Although dark matter interacts weakly, the hope is that it interacts enough that if you have enough chances for dark matter to interact, you would find it. And there are reasons to believe that the dark matter mass is connected with the kinds of questions we're answering at the Large Hadron Collider, and therefore we have some idea of what its mass and interactions could be. So that's one type. Another type of experiment that exists has to do with indirect detection, dark matter finding other dark matter particles, annihilating, that is to say, turning into energy, and then turning into particles and antiparticles that we can hope to discover. And finally, the Large Hadron Collider, in addition to answering these questions about elementary matter, the matter that we know about having to do with their masses and why those masses are what they are, might also shed light on dark matter. And the reason for that is fascinating. It turns out that if dark matter particles had mass that can be studied at the Large Hadron Collider, they would have just about the right amount of energy today. That is to say, masses that fit into what the Large Hadron Collider can look for actually fit very well into what we know about dark matter. So another thing that's going on at that Large Hadron Collider are searches to see if we can find any evidence of dark matter particles of those masses.
So fascinating. So it's really the missing stuff, it sounds like, it's looking for.
Well, it's part of the missing stuff. And the other side, I should say, is as a theorist, there's a lot of new theoretical ideas. It's one of the things that I and my colleagues are working on about what dark matter can be. What is it that fits all the evidence we have, and how would we find it?
Let's take at least one more call. Timothy is calling from Gloucester. Hi, Timothy.
Hi, Anthony. My question relates to the speed of light that the Hadron Collider is has some information that it may not be a constant in a vacuum. Many moons ago, I happened to work on pattern recognition and artificial intelligence and molecular structure, and I decided that theoretical physicists are real sneaky and asked the fellow to instruct me in that. And as I started playing with a little bit of the quantum mechanic equations, I came up with something that said, oh boy, speed of light may not be a constant. And he said, Timothy, go back to biophysics and stay away from physics. But now I understand that there's a possibility that this may be the case. Could you
So this is an important idea. Again, one of the important themes in my book is scale and how ideas build on themselves. In fact, we have tested Einstein's theory very well, and it works. There's a lot of evidence that over the domains in which we've tested it, the speed of light is constant. That doesn't mean that beyond what we've tested, things can't be different. Of course, we'd want a theoretical framework in which that all made sense, and we'd want it to match what reality is. And we want to see, is there actually evidence for it? In the case of this particular measurement, they found neutrinos, elementary particles, like electrons, but that don't have charge. When they did a measurement, and not at the Large Hadron Collider, but at CERN to Gran Sasso, someplace in Italy, they found their measurement seemed to indicate neutrinos were traveling faster than the speed of light. They don't really believe that measurement, and neither does most of the physics community. They put out the measurement because they did actually a very impressive job, and they don't know what's wrong. They want to see, are there ideas to explain what's going on? Are there theoretical ideas by which this would make sense? But even if it turned out to be right, and like I said, I doubt very much it will, it doesn't mean that Einstein's theory is wrong. It means that it's an approximation. The same way that Newton's laws aren't wrong, they're an approximation. Quantum mechanics is true, and you see it if you get to very tiny scales. Relativity is true, you see it if you get to very high speeds. But unless you have the precision to see the difference, you won't know that Newton's laws are wrong. And in fact, in Newton's time, he couldn't. In the same way, it could turn out that Einstein's theory is not the ultimate answer. But so far, it certainly has been successful.
It'll have to do for now. Lisa Randall, I want to ask you, sort of in the minute or so that remains, where will particle physics be 30 years from now, 40 years from now? Do you dream about that, imagine that? Where are we going?
You know, it's funny because, of course, you have to have big questions. In terms of the research you do, you're thinking about what's going on today. A lot will depend on what we find at the Large Hadron Collider, what directions it puts us in, and of course also the resources that we decide to put into basic science. Will we get answers even beyond what the Large Hadron Collider will tell us? And also, what will cosmology tell us? So I do think we will understand a lot more about elementary particle masses. We'll understand about why these masses are what they are. We probably will make inroads in understanding gravity. I don't know if we'll have the ultimate answers. We'll probably understand how forces fit together better. But really, no one ever predicts these things correctly. So you shouldn't trust my predictions anymore. So I'm not going to make any more ambitious predictions beyond that. I think that we have some really interesting set of questions today, and we're hoping we'll answer them within the decade.
Well, Lisa Randall, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today. It's been fascinating. We're very grateful to you.
Thanks for having me here. It's been fun.
Lisa Randall is a professor of theoretical physics at Harvard University. She's the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, How Physics and Scientific Thinking Illuminate the Universe and the Modern World. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.